were seeing differences in the neck, and then the most significant is in the lower legs.
Inside the Push to use female crash test dummies to check car safety, and this week's big step forward for that effort.
It's Friday, November 21st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead, we'll hear from a one-time education secretary on the new plan to dismantle the department.
This is the wrong approach to what really is a very urgent crisis. Our performance today is below where it was before COVID. We should be doing more, not less.
And our word of the week is something that may be popping up in your texts and emails right about now. Yes, we will invite you over for a Friendsgiving.
It had reached a level of popularity. It looked like it wasn't going to go anywhere.
Plus, ahead of this weekend's finals, we'll hear about the songs and cheers of the NWSL.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump and New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani set aside their political differences and discussed their shared goals. During an Oval Office meeting today, Trump says he expects to help Mamdani, not hurt him.
We had a meeting today that actually surprised me. He wants to see no crime. He wants to see housing being built. He wants to see rents coming down, all things that I agree with. Now, we may disagree how we get there.
When it comes to their differences on immigration enforcement, Trump said they could work them out. The meeting came after Trump called Mamdani a communist lunatic. Mamdani has called Trump an authoritarian. But the sit-down offered Mamdani an opportunity to talk with the most powerful person in the world, and it gave Trump a high-profile chance to talk about affordability at a time when he's trying to show he's addressing the cost of living. Most air traffic controllers will not qualify for $10,000 bonuses for perfect attendance during the federal government shutdown. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
Only 311 air traffic controllers out of more than 10,000 will qualify for the cash bonuses, according to the controllers' union. Controllers were required to work without pay during the 43-day shutdown. Some took on second jobs, and many called out sick as they dealt with the financial pressure of missing two full paychecks and part of a third. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says the bonuses, originally suggested by President Trump, are intended to reward the patriotic men and women who did not miss a single shift during the shutdown. But some controllers called the bonuses unfair and a betrayal. Their union said, quote, more than 311 of these dedicated professionals were instrumental in keeping America moving. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is giving his first public comments on a U.S. peace proposal to end the war in Ukraine. Putin says the plan could be an important step towards a peaceful resolution of the conflict, though he suggested much remains to be worked out, as NPR's Charles Maines reports.
At a meeting with his Security Council, Putin was asked to comment on widespread media reports of the U.S. peace plan. Kremlin leader confirmed Russia had received the U.S. proposal, adding he thought it could be the basis for a lasting settlement. Yet Putin cautioned that the U.S. had not discussed its ideas substantively with Russia, arguing it likely meant the White House had yet to convince Ukraine to accept terms. Putin also insisted Moscow would achieve its objectives in Ukraine either way, pointing to recent Russian gains on the battlefield. Critics of the U.S. plan say it tilts heavily in Russia's favor, with calls for Ukraine to cede territory, cap its military, and renounce ambitions to join NATO. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Rain is drenching parts of Southern California, leading to new flash flood warnings. The heavy rains also threaten to bring mudslides in areas recently ravaged by wildfire. After a day of wild swings, major U.S. stock indexes closed up. The S&P 500, Dow, and NASDAQ all gained around 1%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. France is taking action against Elon Musk's AI chatbot, Grok, after it generated posts questioning the use of gas chambers at Auschwitz. Officials say Grok used language associated with Holocaust denial. The Auschwitz Memorial highlighted the issue, saying it distorted historical fact. France has strict Holocaust denial laws. The flight restrictions that were imposed during the government shutdown have lifted in time for one of the busiest travel times of the year, but some travel snags are still in store for many Americans on the go for football, food, and family. NPR's Amy Held reports.
If you have travel plans early to midweek leading up to Thanksgiving, then there could be some issues.
Meteorologist William Churchill says the system behind flooding rains in Southern California is also on the move, bringing potential flooding to the Dallas-Fort Worth area and rain elsewhere.
Like places from the Mid-South, Memphis, St. Louis, eastward.
For the return trip, Americans will be giving thanks for milder weather. Traveler numbers are reaching new heights, though, according to AAA. It projects a record near 82 million people are getting away for the week starting Tuesday, mostly by car. Leftovers from the shutdown. AAA says recent flight cancellations could be motivating even more motorists. Amy Held, NPR News.
The U.S. government has released a new crash test dummy design that advocates believe will help make cars safer for women. Women are 73% more likely than men to be injured in a head-on crash and 17% more likely than men to be killed in any car crash. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy skies with lows 21 to 31 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, becoming sunny, highs in the mid to upper 40s.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This week, the Trump administration gave the green light to a crash test dummy based on a female body. In the U.S. right now, when car makers test their vehicles, they are only required to use dummies based on male bodies. Efforts to add a female dummy have been underway for years. NPR's Camila Domonoske has been following the issue and joins us now. Hey there.
Hi.
So I can picture a crash test dummy in my head. I feel like I see the slow motion video of the car crashing. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I don't actually know what car companies are doing with these dummies and the information they gather.
Yeah, the most important thing to understand is that the dummy that you see is packed with sensors, and it is designed to measure, to quantify how much force a body part is experiencing in a crash. So the dummies are not just shaped like people on the outside. They are designed to move like a real body would. So, Scott, if you think about your head and mm-hmm. the weight of your head on your neck, right now, a dummy needs to have a head that weighs as much as a human head, thereabouts. A neck that is as bendy as a human neck is. That's called biofidelity. It's basically the whole logic behind a crash test dummy. I was actually in the factory where a company called Humanetics makes crash test dummies a couple months ago. Engineering manager Jonathan Keck pointed out to me a shiny metal part.
This is a pelvis, yeah. This is a male pelvis. This is a Hybrid 350th.
The Hybrid 3 being the current dummy design. So dummies also have ribs, they have spines, and all of those parts are packed with those sensors.
I was moving my head and neck around as you explained that. But if all these dummies have heads and pelvises and spines, why is it so important to have a female version?
Data shows that compared to men, women are more likely to be injured in the exact same crash. And meanwhile, cars have all of these safety features designed based on tests that use a male dummy based on a male body. Even when regulations did start calling for a female dummy, it has historically been a small male dummy with some rubber breasts slapped on it. Chris O'Connor is the president and CEO of Humanetics, and he says that just doesn't reflect real anatomy.
Pelvis for a female is more rounded and does not hold the seatbelt the same way. We're seeing differences in the neck. And then the most significant is in the lower legs.
That one sort of surprised me, but the lower legs, anatomically quite different. Women are more flexible, for one thing. Women get way more injuries there. So the new body is based on the female body, and it's designed differently, and, you know, it has a lot more sensors in the calf area, for instance.
I'm curious, are there any arguments against requiring female dummies?
There has been some pushback. You know, one argument is that adding a single female dummy just doesn't reflect the wide range of real bodies, especially a very small female dummy, which this one is. It's not close to the average woman. So you would still be really relying on computer models to extrapolate anyway. It would also be very expensive for car makers to adopt this new dummy. Dummies last for a long time, and a new one can cost $1 million or more. So, you know, obviously Humanetics wants to sell more dummies, and car companies might prefer not to buy them. them. So there has been a bit of a debate. But the federal government has very clearly signaled for years that it wants to have this female dummy. And regulators worked with Humanetics to design it. It's just taken a very long time to get across the finish line.
When would companies actually start using them?
You know, the Department of Transportation just told me in a statement the auto industry could use the dummy immediately, but it will take time for it to be worked into mandatory federal tests. They're going to actually change the testing requirements to include this dummy in 2027 or 2028. An advocacy group that has called for these dummies to be used welcomed this design step forward, but is still calling for a law to require that the dummy be used.
NPR's Camila Domonoske, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When President Trump nominated Linda McMahon as Secretary of Education for his second term in office, this was his main directive to her.
I want Linda to put herself out of a job.
Put herself out of a job. In essence, dismantle the Department of Education. This week, the Trump administration took a big step toward reaching that goal. It announced it would shift several education department functions to other government agencies. The department was established by Congress, and it can only be eliminated by Congress. John King was Education Secretary in the Obama administration, and we called him up to get his thoughts on the changes. He joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
One of the administration's main arguments for making this change is they say American students are floundering after the pandemic. We see that American students still struggle with things like math and reading. Couldn't that be an argument that it's time to shake it up, try something new?
It's an argument, I think, for focus. And this move of offices from the department to different agencies in an incoherent fashion is the opposite of focus. It's a distraction. We should be focused on things like intensive, high-quality tutoring, which we know helps students make up ground. We should be focused on trying to attract and retain the best possible teachers. And yet the administration is cutting programs that support teacher preparation. So this is the wrong approach to what really is a very urgent crisis. Our performance today is below where it was before COVID. We should be doing more, not less.
Current Education Secretary Linda McMahon makes the argument that these moves will actually make things more efficient and will improve services. It sounds like that is not something you agree with.
Now, look, it's going to be very confusing for schools, school districts, higher ed institutions to even know who to call. The early evidence from one of their moves, which was to move some career and technical education programming over to the Department of Labor, is that it has slowed the distribution of money and made things more confusing for educators. It's not helping.
I want to ask you about one specific change that was announced last week. It was the decision to put the Labor Department in charge of managing Title I funding, which of course is money that helps schools support low-income students. If the money is still available, help us understand why it matters if there's a different department distributing it.
Well, you want folks involved in the distribution of the money who understand the program, who understand how the dollars are going to be used. You want them to be able to help provide guidance to school districts and schools about what the rules are that Congress has set up and to make sure that the dollars are responsibly used. Moving this over to another agency that has no experience in K-12 is only adding risk that the school districts won't have the help they need and that dollars won't reach the most vulnerable students.
Not every function of the education department is moving to another agency. Things like civil rights, special education, and student loans are all going to stay within the education department. Give us your sense of what you make of the decision to keep those in the education department rather than moving them elsewhere.
Well, at this point, it's hard to know if this is just a next step in their effort to dismantle the department and they'll come back with other moves. You know, I think they're trying to navigate violating the law as they do this, right? They are doing the opposite of what Congress has set out. Congress created the Education Department. Congress appropriated funds to the Education Department. They're trying to get around that. I hope that the courts will intervene, and I hope that Congress will intervene.
What do you hear from your colleagues, other leaders in education, about what impact this might have on the nation's students?
Well, people are very worried. I mean, they already are seeing the consequences of the dismantling of the Office for Civil Rights. Regional offices have been closed. People have been laid off. And so if you are a victim of discrimination on the basis of race or sex or disability, you don't have anywhere to go. A large share of the complaints that come to the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights come from families of kids with disabilities who aren't getting the services they're entitled to. Without the Office for Civil Rights having adequate staff, those complaints go unaddressed, and those students go without the services they need to access education. That is immoral from my perspective and counter to who we are as Americans and what we believe about giving everyone opportunity.
It's clear that access to a strong public education isn't equal in this country. If this is not the right way to improve things for American students, what is?
Look, I would love to see things like investing in teacher training, tutoring, and after-school programs and early childhood programs so that kids growing up in difficult circumstances have a real shot. It would mean doubling the Pell Grant and making it possible for more low and middle-income Americans to get a college education and get the skills they need for good jobs. We really need a president and an education department that want our schools to be the best in the world, not that are focused on shuffling activities from one agency to another.
We've been speaking with John B. King, former Secretary of Education under President Obama. He is currently Chancellor of the State University of New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've ever spent any time around children, you know they are typically full of questions, which means they make great sports reporters.
Coach, who is the best listener on the team?
So what do you do for a living?
I have a joke for you. Why did the hockey rink get hot after the game?
I don't know.
Because all the fans left.
Those were youth reporters Donovan O'Dowd with the Chicago Blackhawks, Reese Jackson with the New Orleans Pelicans, and Callie Caruso with the Columbus Blue Jackets. And coaches usually have relaxed answers.
But when Boston Celtics coach Joe Mazzulla was recently asked a question from one intrepid reporter, Rusty Smith of Sports Illustrated Kids.
It's Kids Day here at the Garden. How do you balance pushing players to improve while also keeping the game fun for them?
Mazzulla's answer didn't make light of the question. It was like Smith had hit him right in the Achilles.
I struggle with that, to be honest with you.
Mazzulla said it is hard to define fun for professional athletes. And then he finished with some advice for Smith.
But, you know, that phrase can be a cop-out sometimes. So as you get older, kid, don't use it, you know? It's like, I just want to have fun. It's like, well, what does that mean? You just got to define that. It's a good question.
His response got people talking, with one headline reading, Mazzulla gives extremely blunt answer to Kids Day question. But for real fans of the coach, I mean, this was really classic Mazzulla. He's known for really intense answers and odd quotable quips.
I mean, like, you just got to tap into your darkness.
So for kids and reporters alike, keep asking questions. Even if you think you know the answers, you probably don't.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phonology with John Latimer. We receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. More details online at HibbingChrysler.us. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phonology.
On today's date, November 21st, 1986, I come across first the evidence and then the bird itself. Black-backed woodpeckers are not common here, but they do frequent the area and like the black spruce swamps and tamarack trees. And if you happen to be out in an area like that, the easiest way to know if there are black-backed woodpeckers in the area is to look at the snow and look for bark, because these woodpeckers are magicians when it comes to flaking bark off of trees and finding insects that would be hiding beneath the flakes of bark. I once watched one that made just a stroke on one side and maybe two strokes on the other, and off would pop a piece of bark. And then if there were an insect there, he would gobble it up. And the same thing would happen again. Maybe two strokes and then a stroke on the other side and gobble up anything that might be underneath. The ultimate result is that the snow underneath these trees gets all covered in flaked bark. And if you happen to see that, make your efforts to discover the black-backed woodpecker that has been feeding in that area.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. The finals of the National Women's Soccer League are happening this weekend in San Jose, California, and fans traveling from Washington, D.C. and from New York and New Jersey are showing up for their teams not just by donning jerseys and watching the game. But also by raising their voices. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports how fans' songs and chants bring everyone together on game day.
The members of the Spirit Squadron, a major supporters group for the Washington Spirit soccer team, have been preparing all season to cheer on their players this Saturday. Meredith Bartley is the squadron's leader.
We have a chant just for when we score. We have a chant for having a blast. This season, we've started in the 51st minute a Free DC chant. Free DC!
Free DC! This is a nod to the push for DC home rule and statehood. It began when the Trump administration sent National Guard troops into DC earlier this year.
And we have a chant for when it's been a little bit and it's kind of a little boring and we want to pretend like we just scored a goal to get everybody hyped back up again.
That one is inspired by this staple of British football matches, I mean soccer games, belted out here in a YouTube clip featuring Tottenham Hotspur fans. Supporters of Washington Spirit's opponent at this weekend's finals, Gotham FC, have also adopted songs that are popular in UK soccer stadiums. This John Denver hit from YouTube has been a staple at Manchester United's Old Trafford Stadium for years. In 2023, Gotham FC followers decided to put their own spin on it. Gotham Road, take me home
to the place I belong. To use Country Roads was actually my idea.
This is Marge Ligori. She heads up the big Gotham FC fan group, Cloud Nine.
I do also happen to be a Manchester United fan, so I kind of borrowed that, but worked with supporters to adapt the lyrics.
Ligori says the song is special because it evokes a sense of home.
And I think that's what we find in our arena and in our community with our team.
Really, the team is more of just a metaphor for the community.
This is Max Jack, an ethnomusicologist at Indiana University who focuses on sports music. He says chanting and singing allow fans to go through the emotional journey that is a soccer game together.
It creates a sense of stranger intimacy that is incredibly deep and fulfilling. It offers something that most people won't access in their day-to-day life.
And singing and chanting also enable moments of interaction between players and fans. Gotham FC supporters serenade defender Mandy Freeman. Mandy Freeman! In this YouTube clip, Freeman looks visibly moved. The soccer star sheds tears and shares hugs across the spectator railings. Gotham FC's vice president of communications, Jeff Greer, says the team gets a big kick out of the fans' vocal support.
When we hear them chanting, we know that they are at our backs, pushing us to victory.
That's a sentiment shared by the opposition. The Washington Spirit play at Audi Field in DC. They call it Rowdy Audi because of the stadium's raucous atmosphere and credit the fans for being the 12th player on the field. DC. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
The world's biggest economy will be conspicuously absent from a meeting of the globe's 20 richest nations this weekend as the U.S. boycotts the G20 leader summit hosted by South Africa. Kate Bartlett reports that the Trump administration is snubbing the event over false race-based claims and what it considers the summit's DEI, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, agenda.
On a Johannesburg highway, workers, including Tando and Gema, are busy picking up trash.
We are cleaning for G20, madam. That is coming to our country.
The dilapidated city is getting a last-minute makeover before it hosts a summit for leaders from the group of the world's richest nations this weekend. Even President Cyril Ramaphosa donned overalls and got his hands dirty during a cleanup, telling officials,
"Let's get down to work and make Johannesburg great again."
He might be borrowing President Trump's famous catchphrase, but the U.S. is boycotting Ramaphosa's big event.
We have a G20 meeting in South Africa. South Africa shouldn't even be in the G's anymore, because what's happened there is bad.
Since returning to office, Trump has accused the South African government of confiscating white-owned land and allowing the killing of white Afrikaner farmers. Both claims are false. The government here has repeatedly tried to correct the U.S. administration to no avail. Ramaphosa was taciturn.
And their absence is their loss.
Still, it's a huge blow to South Africa on the global stage. President Javier Milei of Argentina announced he isn't coming in solidarity with Trump. The leader of the world's second biggest economy, Chinese President Xi Jinping, is also not attending, though not as a slight. And Russia's Vladimir Putin can't come as he would face arrest under an international criminal court warrant.
It is symbolic of the fractured global moment that we are in.
William Gumede, an associate professor at Johannesburg's Witwatersrand University, says the summit controversy is a sign of the times.
So it's almost an alternative summit without China and without America.
The summit's themes of solidarity, equality, sustainability are anathema to the U.S. administration, with Secretary of State Marco Rubio saying South Africa is pushing a, quote, DEI and climate change agenda. However, other countries whose leaders are attending, like Germany, have praised the theme. As foreign leaders like British Prime Minister Keir Starmer started to arrive in South Africa on Friday, the U.S.-South Africa spat deepened after Ramaphosa said the U.S. had made an 11th-hour request to send a delegation after all.
We have received notice from the United States about a change of mind about participating in one shape, form or other in the summit.
On Thursday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt didn't hold back.
The United States is not participating in official talks at the G20 in South Africa. I saw the South African president running his mouth a little bit.
She said because the U.S. is taking over the rotating presidency of the G20 from South Africa, the embassy chargé d'affaires, seen as a junior official, would be there for the symbolic handover. However, Ramaphosa's spokesman said on X, quote, "The president won't hand over to a chargé." One of the big questions is whether the end of the summit on Sunday will result in a joint declaration, which the U.S. is unlikely to sign. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Check KXE.org for more information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota, with hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Add resources in your region by emailing news@KAXE.org. And we receive support from L&M Fleet Supply,
carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. Now it's time for National Native News here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. An important report on the missing and murdered Indigenous persons crisis has been removed from the Department of Justice website. Many MMIP awareness advocates and officials have questioned its absence, according to Newsweek. U.S. Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada says the Not One More report disappeared in February. She was with the Senate committee that introduced the 2020 Not Invisible Act, which mandated the report. Cortez Casto and Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska reached out to the Trump administration to have the report reposted, but Newsweek says they were told the White House took it down to comply with the president's executive order that determined there were only two sexes. Cortez Masto's quoted in Newsweek's coverage as saying she firmly believes this isn't about gender, DEI, or wokeness, but about keeping tribal communities safe and providing tribal leaders and law enforcement with the tools they need. A Native Hawaiian organization is tasked with taking care of Native Hawaiians across Hawaii and the continental U.S. when it comes to the health and well-being of Native Hawaiian people. Keopo Relitz, Director of Policy and Strategy at Papa'ola Lakahi, says the organization was created by an act of Congress in the 1980s to address the Native Hawaiian health care system. Relitz was among the more than 2,500 attendees at the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention taking place in Seattle this week.
At home, it means making sure that we're supporting our Native Hawaiian healthcare systems. It also means that we're supporting community-based organizations that are helping to make sure our people are thriving and able to live and thrive in Hawaii. And that also means that they're doing so if they are one of the diaspora Hawaiians. So if they were either born outside of the United States or had to move, we also support community-based organizations that are making sure that they're connected to their identity, connected to resources that they need. Because as we know, as Native people, if we don't have our culture, if we don't have our language, if we don't have that identity, then the core of our well-being is impacted.
Relitz says it's important to be at events like NCAI in order to listen and learn from other Native people. She says it's good to be partners, allies, and advocates, pointing to the partnership, which helped create the Native Hawaiian Health Care Improvement Act, done in collaboration with tribes. Health and wellness are among the many issues discussed at the NCAI gathering, which wraps up on Friday. And it's not every day you get to see an eagle, let alone two together, alive and up close. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it's something visitors of a Phoenix nonprofit recently did while blessing these animals during an annual Native American wildlife celebration earlier this month.
Robert Mesto with Liberty Wildlife is Pasquayaki and honors Eagle Cisco and Anna Sazi with a song.
And they're revered for their strength, their intelligence, and even their healing and protective powers.
Things the Phoenix nonprofit is helping guests tap into, one November Sunday morning.
Pinch some sacred tobacco, take it to the eagle, and say their prayer. And oftentimes the eagles will flap their wings. To feel the wind of the eagle is like the ultimate experience.
That lasted for an hour. Augie Molina, who is Pasquayaki, spiritually prepared people bringing offerings to the birds by burning sage bundles and tapping them with a fan made from feathers, while those being cleansed bathed in the smoke.
When you smudge, it's going to take as long as it's going to take.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Support from Clarkson Potter, publisher of Turtle Island, Foods and Traditions of the Indigenous Peoples of North America by Native American chef Sean Sherman. With ancestral and modern recipes, this cookbook showcases diverse foodways of the continent's regions.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump met with the New York City mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani in a much-anticipated meeting between the president of the United States and the incoming mayor of the biggest city in the country. It was stunning in how gracious it seemed to be.
We agree on a lot more than I would have thought.
Let's just remember that Trump has called Mamdani his little communist mayor, and Mamdani has described himself as Donald Trump's worst nightmare. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Franco, was this meeting as dramatic as some people expected it to be, considering how heated things have been between these guys?
I mean, I'd say no, obviously, but also kind of yes. I mean, there were no rhetorical bombs thrown. Trump didn't double down on the name-calling, but it was kind of dramatic in how cordial it was. I mean, they spoke of their shared interests and plans to partner on things like lowering the cost of housing and groceries and energy.
I expect to be helping him, not hurting him. A big help, because I want New York City to be great. Look, I love New York City. It's where I come from.
Mamdani returned the affection. I mean, it was very clear, though, that he was not there to ruffle any feathers.
I appreciated the meeting with the president, and as he said, it was a productive meeting focused on a place of shared admiration and love, which is New York City, and the need to deliver affordability to New Yorkers.
I mean, Franco, just listening to this, the warmth between them feels a little extraordinary to me.
Yeah, I mean, to me too. I mean, they were all smiles. Trump patted Mamdani on the arm. Even at one potentially tense moment when a reporter asked Mamdani if he still thought Trump was a fascist, before he could answer, Trump actually jumped in, kind of chuckled, and told Mamdani that it was okay to just say yes, that it was easier.
I've been called much worse than a despot, so it's not that insulting. Maybe I think he'll change his mind after we get to working together. Yes, please.
But, you know, let's also be clear that this was one meeting. And Trump can be very charming in person, but things can go very sideways, and they can go sideways very quickly. Mm-hmm. And they do really have some big differences. Trump was asked about some of those on immigration and enforcement and crime. And Trump acknowledged that those are differences while also saying that he expected Mamdani would be a good mayor and that he's likely to surprise some conservatives.
Interesting. I wonder, why is there so much interest in playing nice in this moment? Like, what's really at stake here?
Well, I mean, there's a lot riding on this relationship. I mean, Trump has vowed to pull federal funding from New York City. He's threatened to deploy the National Guard to the city. And as we know, Trump has not shied away from using the powers of the federal government to attack his political opponents. And Mamdani really can't afford that. He can't have Trump having a personal vendetta against New York City.
And what about Trump? Like, what are the politics for him in this situation?
Well, for Trump, he's been struggling in the polls, especially on the economy, and he's been trying to get in on Mamdani's affordability message, which he ran so successfully. Now, Trump won last year on a similar economic message, but he's now been struggling, especially with inflation. So you could make the argument that Trump's kind of trying to ride Mamdani's coattails here on this issue. I mean, interestingly, though, Juana, this new friendliness could also complicate the politics for both sides. I mean, until today, Trump has used Mamdani as a foil, looking to paint him as kind of the face of the Democratic Party, a party full of Democratic socialists, he says. And that was likely going to be the key talking point for the midterms. So all this showing of praise really complicates that message, and it raises some serious political challenges for Republicans as they look to next year.
NPR's Franco Ordonez at the White House. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Trust in the U.S. Congress has been dismal for years, but a bipartisan group in the House thinks that they can restore just a little bit of it. They want to ban lawmakers from trading individual stocks to address the perception that lawmakers are profiting from their jobs. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh reports on the effort.
Tennessee Republican Tim Burchett earlier this week summed up the effort to reform ethics laws on Capitol Hill.
This is a fist fight, folks.
He pointed to a list put out by a private trading firm featuring which lawmakers have the most profitable stock portfolios.
This is pathetic, folks. We all know what's going on. Congress knows what the hell's going on, and it needs to stop.
Burchett is part of a bipartisan group with Rhode Island Democrat Seth Magaziner, who say allowing lawmakers to buy and sell stock undermines the trust in Congress.
Members of Congress have access to all kinds of inside information that the average member of the public does not. So the opportunity for corruption is unacceptable.
Congress passed a law in 2012 known as the Stock Act, Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge. It requires disclosure of any stock trades over $1,000 within 30 days. But it's unevenly enforced and includes just a $200 fine for failing to report transactions. Joe Morelli, the top Democrat on the House Administration Committee, said at a hearing this week that the current system doesn't work.
Regrettable, those reforms are now just band-aids to a gaping, festering wound.
Dan Savickas with the Taxpayer Protection Alliance testified that members of Congress can affect the global economy and the U.S. stock market.
They have the ability to trade based off of non-public information in a way that would land ordinary private citizens in legal hot water.
And he pointed out that many members who trade are beating the market.
According to a 2024 report on data that is available, 46 members of Congress, amongst those who trade, outperformed the S&P 500 last year.
Proponents of banning congressional trading say the hearing was an important step. But if a bill wasn't put on the floor, they would take steps to force the vote, using the same process that led to legislation directing the release of the Epstein files. But Magaziner says there is a silent force on the part of both parties that don't want new restrictions.
The opponents are quiet, right? They don't get in front of the cameras and say, no, we want to keep trading stocks, but they are in the ear of leadership.
A Senate committee approved a similar bill in July, but there's no plan for a floor vote yet. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson voted no then, saying there are already financial disclosure rules, and this bill will make it harder to attract candidates for office.
You could relabel this law, quite honestly, the Career Politician Protection Act.
There are some disagreements about how a ban would work, whether congressional spouses and children and senior congressional staffers involved in writing legislation should also be barred from trading stocks. And for those lawmakers who own stocks now, or enter Congress after a new law is put into place, there are questions about how to divest and how to handle the tax issues after they move investments into mutual funds. House Speaker Mike Johnson, who doesn't trade stocks, supports a ban but hasn't committed to a vote yet. After more than a decade of stalled reform efforts, Pennsylvania Republican Brian Fitzpatrick says he's confident this time there is momentum.
This will get a vote. Trust me.
He stressed that serving in Congress was designed to be temporary.
Public service is supposed to be a sacrifice. You're supposed to give things up as part of that public service. And this is the least of which we can do.
There are efforts to broaden the ban to apply to the federal judiciary and to the president and vice president. But for now, the House group says it's time to vote to police Congress. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch Pod, for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. This week, the delights of owl pellets. New episodes come out on Thursdays. Rife Theater Arts presents Disney's The Lion King Jr., November 21st through the 23rd at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids. Shows are at 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday, with 2 p.m. shows Saturday and Sunday. Tickets at rifecenter.org. The Bemidji Senior Center is looking for donations of gently used holiday decorations ahead of their sale on December 5th. Donations may be dropped off at the Senior Center on 3rd Street in downtown Bemidji, weekdays from 9 to 4. Now it's time for North Star Stories here on KAXE KBXE.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
the state releases new information about hemp licensing for next year. Then, an artist community is using unique ways to connect to new audiences. And the Minnesota Zoo has a new permanent resident. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture is now accepting applications for 2026 hemp growing and processing licenses. Licenses apply only to industrial hemp, not cannabis or hemp-derived products. This year's process includes new license fees, added costs per location, and all hemp lots must undergo pre-harvest THC testing, the primary psychoactive compound found in the cannabis plant. More information is available on the department's website. In today's main story, a grassroots publication in northern Minnesota is making it easier for artists to find new audiences. It all starts with a simple question: where's the show? Lydia Moran has more.
In a world of music streaming algorithms and oversaturated social media, a grassroots resource is connecting artists and audiences the old-fashioned way. Christy Olson started a paper zine called On the Record in 2023. She wanted to make it easier for people to attend events in the Twin Ports area, also known as Duluth, Minnesota, and Superior, Wisconsin.
Some of them run out within 24 hours.
On the Record is a comprehensive calendar of arts events in the area. There's also career development resources, reviews, audition notices, poetry, and articles by local artists about the challenges facing creatives in 2025.
I have my handy dandy spreadsheet.
Christy spends about 30 hours a week compiling the zine, in addition to working as a sound engineer at a local venue.
I sift through the Facebook events, pull up any snapshots of posters.
She says most calendars rely on artists to submit their shows, a task that can easily be forgotten about. But On the Record, make sure no one falls through the cracks.
And I also started this project a few months after my mom died of cancer. So partially with that manic energy that grief gives you, but also in honor of her as well, because she was a multidisciplinary artist.
Every other week, a team of volunteers distributes nearly 600 copies across the Twin Ports.
With media being defunded in the world right now, it's so valuable to have a physical, tangible thing you can pick up and take with you and keep in your purse.
When singer-songwriter Elsa Krantz moved to Duluth about 2 years ago, On the Record was their door into the arts community.
You can learn about something that's happening around the block, this really hyper-localized resource.
Elsa helped the zine obtain grant funding to cover printing costs. In the future, Christy hopes local arts-related businesses will sponsor the publication. She said grant money is drying up due to federal changes.
We inch closer and closer to dead internet theory every day.
Musician Ross Thorne is a founding member of the Twin Ports Artist Collective,
where it's really just bots commenting on bots' posts, liking bots' music, you know, all of this stuff. Nothing can take you away from the real world. Like, once you have that piece of paper in your hand, you're just engaging in so many aspects of, like, real community.
Ross said real community is key to sustaining the region's cultural resources.
We'll have a lot of up-and-coming artists that, like, find some success, and then they move away. And what I hope is that Duluth becomes a place where we pay very well, we uplift them so well, that they want to come back or they just stay here. You know, that we're creating this arts hotspot.
For North Star Stories, I'm Lydia Moran.
Anything you want if you just take a little walk with me down the path of your fears.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Well, a 310-pound loggerhead sea turtle named Snooki is settling into her new home at the Minnesota Zoo. Stranded on the New Jersey shoreline in 2016, Snooki could not be released back into the wild due to a medical condition. Now she'll make her permanent home in the zoo's 250,000-gallon Atlantic Reef habitat. Zoo officials say that the exhibit offers Snooki room to explore and swim, providing a dynamic environment for her continued care and recovery.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Thanksgiving is just a few days away, but for many people, the festivities started even earlier with Friendsgiving. In our latest installment of Word of the Week, NPR's Rachel Treisman dives into the very real history of this made-up holiday.
People have been celebrating Thanksgiving with friends for generations, well before the 90s TV show by that name or even a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving in the 1970s.
Peppermint Patty's invited herself, Marcy, and Franklin over for Thanksgiving dinner.
But the word Friendsgiving didn't come along until relatively recently. Merriam-Webster started tracking it in 2007, after it appeared online.
There are your friends, and there's Thanksgiving.
Emily Brewster, a senior editor at Merriam-Webster, says it's easy to see why it caught on.
People can see the word, know instantly what it means, and if it seems useful to them, they will adopt it.
Friendsgiving popped up in news articles and lifestyle blogs before its big break in 2011.
So Friendsgiving appeared in a Bailey's ad, and then it was also in the Real Housewives of New Jersey. Apparently, the episode was called Gobble Fellas.
Google searches for Friendsgiving spiked that year, and every year for the rest of the decade. Merriam-Webster added the word to its dictionary 5 years ago.
It had reached a level of popularity. It looked like it wasn't going to go anywhere.
Friendsgiving is especially popular with younger generations, even more so since the COVID pandemic. There aren't any official statistics on how many Americans celebrate it, but recent online surveys suggest that number could be as high as 20%.
I think probably around the time that the word got adopted into the lexicon is when we started to get questions about it.
That's Lizzie Post, the co-president of the Emily Post Institute, which offers etiquette advice.
And there were questions along the lines of, can you only do Friendsgiving if your family isn't around and you can't travel to them?
Not at all. People who celebrate Friendsgiving tend to do so in addition to their family Thanksgiving, not instead of it. Friendsgiving meals, like the one I co-hosted recently, are typically potlucks.
Wherever you want. No pressure.
These days, Post gets a lot of questions about potluck etiquette. But she says there's no one right way to celebrate Friendsgiving.
Whether that means eating off of paper plates in front of a football game on the couch, or whether that's a formally set table, matters not. It's the gathering that makes the big difference.
And we can all be thankful for that. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
All right, y'all, it is Friday, and as always, we like to usher in the weekend with some new tunes. Snarky Puppy, the five-time Grammy Award-winning band known for its thrilling live performances, is back with a new album today. It's called Somni, and the music was recorded during three nights of performances with Dutch group Metropole Orkest in the Netherlands earlier this year. Here today to talk with me about it is Justa Sanchez from NPR member station KNKX in Seattle and Tacoma. Hi there.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, Justa, so Snarky Puppy has made a name for itself over the years, but tell me, how would you describe the music?
Yeah, so over the last two decades, Snarky Puppy, they have made a name for themselves creating these rich, exploratory soundscapes that really encompass a whole bunch of different styles. And the main guy behind the sound is the bassist and composer Michael League, and he grew up playing jazz and lots of other different styles as well. So their sound is very expansive, and they're on this record, Somni, there is these incredible symphonic movements and great horn sections. But at the same time, too, it's incredibly funky in a lot of places. There's plenty of world rhythms and big grooves. And also, there's plenty of space in the songs where musicians get to let loose on some solos, which is coming from a jazz station is one of my favorite things. I like that you never quite know what to expect with this band and the record as you listen. I'd say that is one of the cornerstones of Snarky Puppy, like the track Camaro, which takes a dark, ominous turn after a few songs that have a little bit brighter moods.
I mean, you can totally hear that there. Justice, this music was recorded live. Tell us about their shows.
So back in January of this year, they did this in front of a live audience in the Netherlands for 3 nights with the Metropole Orkest, one of the world's premier orchestras today. And they were conducted by Jules Buckley. And beyond the second project with Snarky Puppy, he's worked with Tori Amos, Michael Kiwanuka, and just so many more. But Snarky Puppy, this is their biggest and most ambitious project yet. After they finished the concert, they posted some really great stats that illustrate kind of the vastness of the project. So there was like 74 musicians involved from the orchestra to the chorus Snarky Puppy, which is 20 people on its own. They used 410 headphones during the performance, and there was 256 channels of audio.
Wow.
And the crew in total was about 102 people, and that includes a film crew as well. So you'll be able to watch the video of the whole performance on YouTube at some point. So it's a great feat, and just another standout thing about this record is the vastness of the project.
I mean, that sounds pretty impressive. Now, the new album is called Somni. Tell us about the title and, like, what's the overall vibe that they're going for?
Yeah, so the themes of the album come from a place within the mind of Michael Leig, quite literally, because it is called Somni, which is the Catalan word for dreams. He moved to the Catalan region of Spain from Brooklyn in 2018, and the album explores kind of the peculiar, otherworldly, shape-shifting themes that happen in our dreams, and it's kind of like if they had a soundtrack. So each piece is supposed to represent a different part of the experience of dreams and being asleep. And one of the themes is recurring dreams. And that is explored on the vast track Recurrence.
The last time that Snarky Puppy and Metropole Orkest collaborated, I know that they won the Grammy for Best Contemporary Instrumental Album. I haven't heard that album, so can you just tell me, like, how does this album compare?
Yeah, so 2016, they had a project together called Silva. And sonically, though, I'd say that that album is a little bit more minimalistic. There are some smoother electric tones on that one. But if you end up liking Somni, you'll enjoy that album too, and vice versa, because the grooves and the spectacular musicianship and the big arrangements are all there as well.
That's Justice Sanchez of KNKX in Seattle and Tacoma. You can hear more from Justice on the New Music Friday podcast from NPR Music. And Somni, the new album from Snarky Puppy and Metropole Orkest, is out now.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. Fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. United Way of 1000 Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive, now through December 12th. There are several drop-off sites in Grand Rapids and Deer River, including Essentia Health and Northern Star Senex. Find more info at uwlakes.org. Tickets are now on sale for Home is Where the Heart Is, a benefit for Grace House, Itasca County's only homeless shelter. The event is Thursday, December 4th, but tickets must be purchased before November 26th at Grand Rapids Super One stores, Timberlake Lodge, or Grace House. Looking at weather tonight, mostly cloudy skies with lows 21 to 31 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, becoming sunny, highs in the mid to upper 40s, south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour.